Time I'd like to introduce the speaker. I had the privilege of being on the programming committee, my first major service commitment with Narcotics Anonymous. And I'd like to say I remembered all the submissions, all the speakers I heard, but that's not true. I have some short-term memory problems, and but Phil's blew me away, and I'm so honored to be here chairing this meeting, and I'm just blown away that I actually get to meet Phil and hear his message live and in person. And I'm not going to waste any time. I'd like to welcome up Phil O from New York City, New York.
Hello, Canada. I'm a recovering addict from New York City. My name's Phil.
Hi, Phil.
Good to be north of the border. I've been practicing saying things like, oh, in the boat. Yeah, good to be here. If any of you get to New York City, my home group is called Recurring Themes. It's a topic meeting that meets every Tuesday night and Thursday night at 7 p.m. You can find the details by calling our helpline or going online. And I'm always there every Tuesday and Thursday, unless I'm someplace like here. Please visit us when you're there. When I got the call with this topic, the ties that bind us together, let me first say that I take topics seriously. When I get an opportunity to share and they give me a topic, I don't just make a pass at the topic. I consider that my assignment. There's an 11-step aspect to it. Somebody taps somebody on the shoulder to ask Phil to share on that topic because higher power thought Phil needed to take a good look at that topic and where that topic was in his life. So I don't ignore it. Other people go about this differently. I'm just telling you, I always give importance to the topic given me. So when I heard the ties that bind us together, the first thought was, oh, it's traditions. Okay, they want me to come to Canada to share on traditions. I've done it a lot of times. But then I remembered there's a whole chapter in this book called The Ties That Bind. And that sounded exciting to me. Now, I thought I'd be a little willful if I simply picked that rather than traditions, which I've shared on a lot of times. So I prayed on it, and the answer came back, do the one from this book. There's probably some good stuff in there for you, Phil. So that's what I'm going to do. It's called The Ties That Bind. It's a whole chapter in this book, and it has four sections. The Ties That Bind. Ties, as you know, is a bond of kinship, a bond. It also was in the dictionary defined as a cord. A cord used to draw something closed, tight, closed, solid. Whatever's in there can't get out. And the first chapter in this book is about connection to ourselves. To ourselves. I was always alienated from myself. I had what most of us have. If we listen to our stories, not all of us, but most of us had an unhappy childhood. I was overprotected by my mom to the extreme. And I was not allowed out of the house without an adult supervision, an adult escort. I couldn't cross the street. I lived in a small town for fear of a car would come by. And I couldn't play with the kids in the yard next door. I had to stay in the house and be around the adults in the family, and if I went out, I had to be, I was taken to school because it's the law, And I was called for at the end of school and brought right back home to the house. So I just couldn't wait till I was old enough to break out and be out. And in the course of my unhappy childhood, I developed a real strong resentment for my mother. Talking about connection to ourself and how one of the big things I discovered in my recovery that kept me from connecting to myself was the guilt I felt as an adult, the result of the childhood, for the things I did to make my mother feel bad. I had enormous guilt issue. Because when I was old enough, I moved into the big city. And I was an only child, and I was so important to her. But I had very little to do with her as an adult. I made token visits, drive-bys. I would call up and share surface. She wanted me to be the important part of her life. And she was getting older. And I didn't care. And I know I was tearing her heart out. She lived with my aunts and cousins an hour out beside the city, and she was getting older. And I was in the city ripping and running, and I didn't care. And I would make visits, and there'd be this tension in the family because the family didn't like the way I was treating her. And she would make it nice, you know, don't say anything, don't upset him. And I would have a short visit, and then I'd have to go. We talk about parents abandoning their children. I abandoned my mother. And I said hurtful things to her. And I did a lot of harm. In this wonderful book, in this section called Connections to Ourself, it says experiences from our past can make it hard for some of us to see ourselves in a new way. The labels we've applied to ourselves don't allow us to change. She passed years before I got to NA, so she never met this Phil. She met the other guy. And there'll always be some regret about that. But I used over the guilt. I would have flashbacks of the hurt look on her face and some of the things I had the nerve to say to her. And I would feel so bad about myself. And a lot of our program is about changing the way we see ourselves. And let's face it, in active addiction, we did bad things. We did bad things. We all can recount stuff we did. That's a nice song.
Didn't know it was on, sorry.
Yeah, that's okay. Experiences from the past get in the way of our seeing ourselves differently. The way I acted using, and hopefully you can identify with this, was not me. It was me under the influence. It was me it was like having a gun to my head and the disease would say, do this, and I would do it. There was no choice involved. So I had to do a lot of work to relieve myself of this tremendous guilt. And I wrote about it in the fourth step. I wrote about what I was aware of, the things I did. And I got to the fifth step and shared it with my sponsor. And I got to the place where I talked about my mother and what a bad son I was. And how could I have done the things I did, said the things I did, ignored her, abandoned her. And I'm sobbing. And he says something to me, I forget what, and I'm sobbing, and yeah, but I was so bad to her. Yeah, and he says something else, and finally he said, Phil, you were undiagnosed. And what he was pointing out is until we get here, we identify with what we did back then. We see ourselves as bad people, not sick people. And he took me to the place in the text where it says we sometimes see our past behavior as part of ourselves, not part of the disease. to separate that out. It's going to take more work. The sixth step, I got in touch with a defect called remorse. Remorse is when we regret the past and put a lot of energy into thinking back what I could have done different, might have done different, would have done different. The past is in the books. That's a lot of wasted energy. I needed to get with some acceptance. I had the disease of addiction. I did bad things. One of the manifestations was how I treated my mother. But I'm not a bad person. I took a lot of work. I was still working on the eighth step. Because when I wrote about the nature of the harm done, that writing we do in the eighth step, I wrote about the nature of the harm, and I segued off into the harm she did me. The harm she did me, the way she brought me up. My sponsor said, no, you can't go on to nine. You have to separate what she did to you from what you did to her. He said, you may not get to forgiveness. That's a big leap. You may not be able to forgive her, because I'll tell you in a little while the effect of my growing up the way I grew up. He said, work on two things. Work on acceptance and understanding. Understanding. She brought you up in a kind of peculiar way, yes. But what do you know about her that might have explained it and might lead you to look more kindly on the way she brought you up? And I remembered back that she was in an unhappy marriage with my father. And there was talk of, and it happened, that there was a baby before me that died prematurely. Uh-huh. And she was in her mid-30s, and women didn't just get divorced back, we're talking the middle of the 20th century, they didn't just get divorced like that, and they didn't just remarry. I was her only chance or only opportunity for motherhood. And I began to understand why she was so overprotected. Nothing must happen to little Philip. And it began to change the way I looked at her. And the whole acceptance thing is that the past can't be changed. It can't be changed. It already happened. Do I want to still be miserable about it? Do I want to still spend a lot of remorse energy into reconfiguring it? So this wonderful book talks about that experience from the past is hard. It takes a special kind of work. And it goes on to talk about other things that affect our connection with ourself. And one of the things that stood out for me, it says, we find out how much our identity was tied up in what we did for a living. Now, all during my active addiction, there was one area of my life where I felt like somebody. One area. My life was in shambles. I had no social life. People didn't stick around. I had a lot of loneliness, a lot of solitary time. But while I was working, I felt like somebody. I was doing something a little unusual, nothing special, but I was good at it, and people referred people, and I began to be popular and in demand and all of that. And it was that one area of my life. It goes on to say we may not want to admit that what worked for us yesterday is no longer in our best interest. Well, at the end of active addiction, I had begun to use during work hours. In this one area, that was the one thing that was good. So what happened? Well, one by one, people stopped coming to me. At the end, there was no business. I come in at NA, I get clean. A couple of years into this, I get a bright idea. I'm going to restart my business. I can be clean and do this too. I used to advertise in a certain publication. I had a certain price. I wasn't going to change anything. I ran the same ads in the same publication that used to produce phone ringing off the hook, new clients all the time. It's only 2 years later. I ran the same ads, nothing. I ran another round of ads, nothing. I wasn't supposed to go back to that kind of work because it caught me up. I might have sloughed off on my recovery looking back at this. At the time, I was pissed off. I want my business back. It goes on to say, we may not want to admit what worked yesterday is not in our best interest. The more willing we are to move forward in life, the more fully we become ourselves, connection to ourselves. So I couldn't go back to that. And I realized later I shouldn't have gone back to that. And I tried something else for a couple of years, an old thing I wanted to do all my life, and I had the opportunity, and it was okay, you know. And then I tried something else for a couple of years. And then I was old enough where I could see, we have this thing in America called Social Security, you probably call it something else, and Medicare, and you probably call your version something else. But I was within sight of those things, and I crunched some numbers, and I realized I could retire early. All I had to do was be frugal. But I've been cheap all my life, very tight with money. So being frugal was not a challenge. And I was able, and it's been great. It's been great because I've been able to do this, to do recovery, to make multiple meetings some days, and a meeting every day, and do service, and really commit to recovery and really get the benefits. So what seemed like a terrible situation, a real disappointment, turned out to be wonderful. And the fact that I didn't have to rely on my livelihood for my identity gave me this whole new identity. So, connection to myself, the work we do here, the step work we do here, allows us to get rid of those feelings that we're bad people, whatever your version of it. Step work will help you with that. And then we'll be able to see that things that happen in our life are for a reason. What comes next? What's the next thing we're supposed to do? Never mind regretting that didn't turn out. And today, I feel pretty good about myself. There's another section. It's a four-part section on the ties that bind us. And the next section is called Connection to a Higher Power. Connection to a higher power for me? I'm the guy that got here as an agnostic. I'm the guy that looked at the things on the wall with the 12 steps, and I see the G-O-D word, and I'm liking coming to N-A, and I'm really getting into this, but that's the stumbling block. See, nothing ever works out. This won't work out either. You got to get one. Oh, that's out of the question. I had never. How is it? I would run up to experienced members, and I would tell them that, and they would say, keep coming, Phil. You'll find something. A G-O-D, something. All right. I would sit in meetings, and somebody inevitably would say, I want to thank my higher power, who I choose to call, and they would say the name of a deity associated with organized religion, and I would flip. And I would run up to these experienced members, and they'd have to calm me down. See, it's a religious program. I just keep coming, Phil. You'll find something. In this book, 31, come on, concentrate, Phil. 31 comes after 29, right. It says, it says, visiting steps 2 and 3, we can find a relationship that makes more sense to us, a relationship to this thing called a higher power, coming out of steps 2 and steps 3. And that was my experience, because until then, no way. But something happens if we do a thorough second step, collect a lot of evidence, are in no hurry to get to the third step, don't pass over it with a minimum of concern. And I had a series of experiences, very strange experiences, where I would want to hurt myself in some way, and I would go to a meeting or raise my hand or make the phone call, and I would share what I wanted to do so so I wouldn't do it, or what I didn't want to do so I would do it, or I would outright ask for help. And after I did that, the willingness to not hurt myself came over me. Active addiction, I used to go to countries known for the availability of drugs. I used to go to the guidebook in the stores and read about where in the country they sold drugs, because guidebooks tell you that. They're really telling travelers, tourists, don't go there. That's why I knew I could find it in the guidebook. And I would write down the name of that part of the country, and I'd get a ticket and fly there and find, and I would scope it out. And in very dangerous circumstances, I would cop drugs through the funny money barrier, the language barrier, sign language. I would put myself in great jeopardy. So I come into recovery, and those days are over, but I always did enjoy travel. So I wait a couple years before I travel, but I get a bright idea, and I want to go to this place and see this site and that site, and I'm reading about it. And I'm planning to go, but I thought I'd let my sponsor know, let him know, at least I'll be away these dates. I wasn't calling to ask him. I wasn't running it by him. I'm going. And I called him up and I said, I'm going to be away from this date to that date. And he says, where are you going? And I told him the country. And he says, where is that? Because I picked an odd country to visit. And I said, it's in South America. He says, where in South America? I looked at the map. I said, it's between Peru and Colombia. It's called Ecuador. They have these amazing things there, the Galapagos Islands. Blah, blah, blah. He said, I suggest you not go there. And I'm talking about a second step where we share what we want to do that may hurt us. All those things we call insanity are the self-destructive side of us. We want to do something, but it's going to hurt us. If we verbalize it and pause, something happens. I hung up the phone and I didn't go. I had a series of those experiences. I hurt my back, went to a meeting, a bunch of people walked me to the drugstore and got some over-the-counter stuff. I wanted to take a pain pill, unprescribed. Things happen when we verbalize what we're thinking of doing. If we collect enough experiences, there's a logical question at the end of the second step. I like to call it step 2.5. What made these things happen? What force, what thing? And whatever answer we come up with can be the beginning of a relationship with a higher power. I began to have a relationship with something I call the force that's working in my life. Those are the words I was comfortable with. Other people use other words. There was a force, undeniable. And in the third step, I got some practice catching myself trying to force a result and stopping. Third step action is to stop and then watch what happens. And things would proceed wonderfully and get to a result that was beyond what I could have conceived or forced a result toward. And I began to collect those experiences and so on and so forth, right up to the ninth step where my sponsor said, this thing with your mother, let's put a cap on it. Go visit her gravesite. Write a letter first. What things would you like to say to her now? And up to that point, I sat in meetings and people would share about their mother, their father, relationships, bad parental relationships and so on, and whatever, and I would start crying in meetings. Or I would get pissed off that, why'd you have to bring that up? I'm having a good day. I went to the gravesite, I read the letter, I cried some more, got back in the car, made a meeting, and ever since then, people still talk about their parents and how they weren't a good son or a daughter. And I'm not crying anymore. I'm okay with it. I'm empathizing, but I'm not mood altered. Something happened. All these things are things that cannot be adequately explained in words. They're in the spiritual realm. Can't touch it, see it, taste it, smell it, but it happened. And it got me believing in something. And I began to develop that relationship. And at one point in this wonderful book, it says, we find out how, when we're in tune with a power greater, we seem to flow more easily with the current in our lives. Flow. There's a flow. Third step says it's a natural and logical flow of events in our life. When we try to swim upstream, it ain't pretty. And I began to notice that in my early recovery days, my home group would get a notice, have to move, you can't use the space anymore, and we'd be scurrying around for a new space, and I'd be panicked, or there's going to be more home group, and I would be emotionally upset about it, and whether it turned out or not, I would have to go through something. Later in stages, groups I'm associated with, we get the same kind of notice. We're looking, I'm okay, something's going to turn up. I'm in the flow. I'm flowing with the current. I'm not mood altered there either. Something's going on. People have left my life for good reason or not good reason. Someone flipped on me. I thought he was a good friend, and suddenly he's saying terrible things to me, and he hates me, and things happen, and I'm able to shrug my shoulders. Gee, that makes room for a new person. That's not a bad thing necessarily. Okay, he doesn't want to stick around. It was never like this. I would always manipulate you to stay. You didn't stay long, but I would try. So I'm talking about a connection with a higher power. Connection in the dictionary is interesting. Relationship having intimacy. So we're talking about intimacy with ourselves, intimacy with a higher power. Funny about the word connection, we never used it that way in active addiction, did we? Connection with the world around us. With the world around us. Page 37, where are you? All right, good. Okay. When my family brought me up this way, they would tell me, Philip, only your family loves you, but when you go out in that world, it's tough. You know, people are not your friend. It's going to be tough. They were telling me the world was a hostile place. A hostile place. I'm a little kid. I don't have the wherewithal to process this. I internalized it. They said it. I guess it's true. I'm growing older. I'm ready to step out in the world. But because I was brought up the way I did without any interaction virtually with people my own age to get some social skills, I'm going out in the world with minus social skills. And other people have been socializing all their young life, and I'm the guy, you may remember somebody like me who didn't know what to do with his hands and couldn't make eye contact and didn't know what to say, couldn't make small talk and didn't know, looked very uncomfortable, made you feel uncomfortable, and that was me. So I approached the world with fear, given this misinformation, unhealthy belief system, the world's a hostile place. I believed it, and I proceeded with fear. I was set up. The world was everyone was out to get me, and nobody was my friend, and I better keep my guard up, and I was feeling so inadequate because people were very comfortable interacting with each other, and I was bullied and ridiculed and kept outside, feeling not part of, and that's who I was. And it talks in here about we struggle with self-obsession. Often a feeling sends us into self. When we practice acceptance, we get the ability to see more of the picture than our limited point of view gives us. And I began, over time, in recovery, began to see that people are just people. They're going about their business. They have their goals. They have their process. And sometimes we interact, and sometimes they're pulling the other way because they have their process, but it's nothing personal. And sometimes we bond and we have a good thing for a while, and then sometimes we go apart, and it's not personal. And that I, if I work on myself, have the wherewithal to handle this stuff. And the world doesn't have to be a hostile place. The world is just the world. And I didn't have to continue believing that misinformation. I have defects. One of them is oversensitivity. Oversensitivity. I can think somebody is dissing me, disrespecting me, when they're not. They're just saying what they say. I have a defect called arrogance sometimes. I can walk down the streets in New York, and I'm on the sidewalk, and there's a bunch of people up there, and I'm getting closer, but they're right in my way. And my thinking says, as I get closer, they should notice Phil's coming and just part. And they don't. And I've learned to simply walk around them. The world isn't a hostile place. They're not out to get me. They're not out to spoil my day, but I can spoil my own day if I barge through and give them some sharp elbows and get into a shouting match. Then my serenity's gone for the next few hours. If I just go around them, even step off the sidewalk, and just, I can keep my serenity and have a beautiful day. They're not the enemy. They're just having a conversation on the sidewalk. So they didn't see me. So what? And today, in my connection to the world, I do service. You know, selfless service. You know, the kind the 12-step talks about. Nobody's looking. When there's a blind person in New York City wanting to cross the street, my heart just opens up to them. I can't imagine a more vulnerable state to be in than to stand at the corner waiting for the light to click that it's changing, and then guessing it changed and barging out into the street. So I offer my services and say, do you want to know when the light changes? Can I help you across the street? Watch out, you're heading toward something. Go a little to the left. I stop what I'm doing. In the old days, in New York City, I was such a grouch that tourists would ask me for directions. This is active. And I was such a grouch, I would know where they wanted to go, and I'd send them the opposite way. Today, I give them good directions. I draw them a map. I walk them part way there. It's a form of service. I don't litter. You know, stuff like that. My connection to the world. And the fourth part of this wonderful chapter talks about connection with others, something that was particularly hard for me to do. No social skills at the beginning, low view of myself. What do I have in common with people? How can I interact with people? I had no skills. I had to start from the beginning. And I came into NA, and it was not that different. And I was sitting there, and I'm hearing a story that in the details of which sounded very different than mine. Very different. I mean, a lot of people in the meetings I went to, we had this clubhouse in New York, a lot of people were homeless, on welfare, living in abandoned buildings, living in the back of the meeting space because they let people sleep there. There was a lot of that kind of hardship. And I'm sitting there thinking, my rent is paid. I have a bank account. I came here because I was getting close to suicide, and I'm not hearing people talk about that. I'm not hearing people talk about having rent paid. I'm hearing all this other stuff. Then there was there seemed to be people every other meeting sharing about this experience that just boggled my mind. There were people saying that they would carry a television down the middle of the street in the middle of the night to sell for $5. I mean, am I in the right place? What am I doing here? And let me see. This wonderful chat. When we sense a connection based on our shared disease and shared recovery, the ways in which we differ from one another become enriching rather than limiting. When we share honestly, we give others the opportunity to connect with us in spite of surface differences. Surface differences, that's all they are. And I remember listening to other people share, and at some point I was going to have to do this and talk about my story. I didn't know I had a story, but I was going to tell them, and I was telling them about those trips I took to those countries and how through the language barrier, and I'm in Midnight Express type countries, and I could have been thrown into a prison over there and never come back, and I could have been set up. I was beat a few times. I was sold some bad stuff, but I was never beaten up, and I'm telling them about this. And at the end of that meeting, there was a circle around me, and I remember this one guy said, "Wow, that reminds me of getting shot by bullets in the South Bronx." And he was making a connection that I was about to learn how to do. He was identifying with the dereliction, putting myself in jeopardy, that he did when he went to COP and got shot at. And learning to identify is a spiritual principle. There's no pamphlet on it, and yet we all seem to learn how to do it. There were those 11 places our disease took us, all of us, some version of dereliction, degradation, isolation, loss of control, distrust of others. We all got some version. And somehow or other, we learn how to transpose your version of that to my version and feel the connection with others. It's an amazing thing. We define ourselves by our choices. The decision not to have a family means we must find other ways to be connected to people. I came in here at 51. My life was over. I had the means necessary to take my life. It was becoming a real possibility. I came to NA and my life totally changed. I'm 74, 23 years clean. Usually I get an applause for 74. So in spite of those surface differences, I stuck around and learned how to identify, and people learned to identify with me, and I get all this love from the fellowship, and I built a family within Narcotics Anonymous. All my blood relatives, those aunts, those uncles, those cousins that my mother stayed with, passed. I have no blood relatives, but I have a wonderful, wonderful family that I am intimate with, I am close to, that are there for me, and I'm there for them in Narcotics Anonymous. Connection with others. So this wonderful chapter says, in effect, that the ties that bind us together, if they're stronger than those that will tear us apart, if we're connected to ourselves, to a higher power, to the world around us, to others, all will be well. Here's what strikes me. This chapter is the second chapter in this whole book. The second chapter. Ties that bind us. It's followed by a whole lot of other wonderful stuff. And while it doesn't say this explicitly, what strikes me is because it's the second chapter, and it says that these four things are very important, to me, that means that what follows is dependent on those four things being in place. That we better be connected to ourselves, sometimes called comfortable in our own skin. That we better be connected to a higher power. Third step called reliance on a higher power, that's a connection. That we better be connected to the world around us. Harmony, it's not a battlefield out here. We can find harmony. And we better be connected to others. We call it, we're tight. It's a New York expression. We're tight with this one and that one. We're tight, meaning we're close, we're intimate, we're together, we're connected. So what that means to me, that if these four pieces are in place and we get it through step work, then we're able to explore how spirituality is practical, how there's a creative action in the spirit, how we can talk about wellness and health and letting ourselves go, how relationships get better, talking about romantic relationships and conscious contact, and we can go on and talk, get into stability and commitment and education and so on, that it's like the prerequisite, getting these four connections. This is a book that is for everyone. There's wisdom in here for everyone, this wonderful book. But it really incorporates a lot of experiences of people that have time and have work steps. And hopefully it's going to keep old timers around, because we tend to lose old timers, don't we? There's a lot in here for people who have, well, I've already said it. But it's all based on those four things, the connections. So I'm going to shut it down. I'm glad my higher power directed me to this book and gave me clearance to choose this. If you came here looking to hear about traditions, we can talk on the side after the meeting. But topics are important. They direct us. They move me along in my process. I learned a lot by researching this share today. I research. I prepare. I do that. I know we hear another philosophy. I'm just giving you a different philosophy from that philosophy. I prepare, and I get a lot out of it, and hopefully you did too. Get this book. It's got a whole lot for all of us. It's great being in Canada. It's great being 74. It's great that the best part of my life came toward the latter part. You know, we live in a society that says youth is the best part of our life. Don't waste youth. Youth this, youth that. But a lot of us had unhappy childhoods. Our youth was not joyous in most cases. And I just want you to know, the best part of your life could be coming right up ahead, like it did for me. Thanks a lot.
I wrote a couple things down here because I wanted to, I knew I was going to be thanking Phil. And I think the thing that I like most about your message, Phil, and the one I heard that you submitted, was like you share your experience, strength, and hope, and you tie it to the literature. And the literature never has ever steered me wrong. And it's not your opinion, it's what the our program teaches us. I don't know if anybody noticed, but when I was sitting beside Phil, he had his Living Clean book open. It looks like it's 100 years old. It was published in 2012. Like it's So it shows that he's like, he's reading that book like over and over again. He's referring to it all the time. It's just awesome. And that you, you know, like the unity message that you submitted, and you did it with this one too. Like you look at the similarities and not the differences, and that's what I've struggled with in the past. I think that's why I really enjoy your message, and I hope everybody else did too. So on behalf of Working at 28, I'd like to thank you, Phil, for sharing your experience, strength, and hope with us. Okay, and I guess we'll wrap it up. We'll close with the wee version of the Serenity Prayer. Danny, want to take a sip?
They're actually pretty nice.